Hello, and welcome to the Humanitarian Practice Network here at the Overseas Development Institute, where I'm joined by Antonio Danini to discuss his new book, The Golden Fleece. Antonio is a senior researcher at the Feinstein International Center at Tufts University in Boston, and he's an expert on issues relating to humanitarianism. Antonio has edited a selection of contributions from seasoned humanitarians in what is this latest publication, The Golden Fleece, and these reflect on some of the world's most devastating crises. Spanning a 150-year history of humanitarianism, the book covers three distinct periods. Firstly, the pre-Second World War era, then 1945 to the end of the Cold War, and finally, the period since the 1990s. At the heart of the book are key questions about humanitarianism, most centrally, whether it is inevitable that the aspirations of humanitarianism will always be subject to manipulation, be it for political, military, or security reasons. But we're going to start by exploring the intriguing choice of the title, The Golden Fleece. And welcome, Antonio. I wonder if you could explain to us why you've chosen this title.
Thank you, Wendy. Great to be here. Well, The Golden Fleece is, of course, a bit tongue-in-cheek. The Greek myth goes, Jason with the Argonauts went into pursuit of this mythical fleece, which was said to represent power, wealth. It's a bit unclear, but we chose this term because of its ambiguity, because it contains the notion of a goal that we aspire to reach, but also at the same time the notion of fleecing. And the book's complete title is The Golden Fleece, Manipulation and Independence in Humanitarian Action. So it's about the relationship between power and the humanitarian impulse and how this relationship plays out in over history and over a diverse set of crises.
I see. And I see that one of the central themes of the book is the challenge to the humanitarian principles of impartiality, neutrality, and independence. Has there ever been a humanitarian operation, in your view, that has succeeded in achieving all of these principles? Do you feel that they're more jeopardized now in modern humanitarian action?
Well, that's a very good question. Because the book is about the Golden Fleece and it's about what we call instrumentalization, the misuse, the manipulation of humanitarian action for purposes that are not humanitarian, political, military, sometimes economical. Because of this, we are focusing very much on the sort of negative aspects of the humanitarian relationship. Maybe in our next book we'll be more positive, but we wanted to lay out, taking a long historical view, the relationship between humanitarianism and politics in particular, and learn from this relationship, asking ourselves whether this instrumentalization that seems to accompany humanitarian action from the very beginning, is this something that is it consubstantial? Is it something that it's inherent in the humanitarian relationship? Or is it something that can be fixed, can be improved? And to answer your question, was there ever a humanitarian response that was totally principled, and neutral, impartial, and independent? I think it's a bit like the fleece. We're more or less there. In some cases, the manipulation has been extraordinarily high. In other cases, it's been less apparent. In some cases, agencies have been able to operate in a more effective and principled manner. I can give you some examples if you like.
Yes, please.
For example, if we look at Afghanistan today, I think most observers would agree that very much of what happens or is called humanitarian in the Afghanistan context is in reality a form of assistance or relief that is related very much to the military political objectives of the West in Afghanistan. So for the past 10, 12 years, it's been very difficult to maintain any kind of semblance that the humanitarian enterprise in Afghanistan was working on the basis of principle. But if we go back in time, even under the Taliban, where there was less money for aid, the Taliban weren't a particularly easy group to work with, because there was less pressure from the citadels of the north in terms of what humanitarian action should look like in Afghanistan, it was possible to maintain a clearer distinction between humanitarian action and political agendas. And it wasn't easy, but there was a sense among the UN agencies and the NGOs in Afghanistan that we were more or less trying to maintain a principled approach in dealing with an abusive regime like the Taliban.
I think you make the point in your book as well that there actually never has been a golden age of humanitarianism. Is that right?
No, I think what our book shows is that some of the pathologies, some of the problems that we see in the functioning of the aid enterprise today have been there from the very beginning. If you look back at even before the enterprise was codified, if you look at, I don't know, Lord Byron and Greece, Lord Byron was using very much the same kinds of tools as Bernard Kouchner was using in the 70s in France, the idea that you use the nascent media, in the case of Lord Byron, to promote a political process or bring issues on the agenda. So I think many in our book, we give a kind of typology of instrumentalization situations, and I just mentioned one. Obviously, the most obvious forms of instrumentalization are when aid is used to reach a political or military objective, as we've seen perhaps today in Afghanistan. But we saw the same thing very much during the Vietnam War, where Western NGOs, American NGOs, were tools of the military propaganda and agenda in Vietnam. What's different is we didn't call Vietnam a humanitarian situation. Now we call Afghanistan a humanitarian situation. But the nature of the instrumentalization was very much the same. And the nature of the debate in the U.S. NGOs during the Vietnam period was very similar to the nature of the debate that we have today. So there seems to be a constant in this tension between the pressure to utilize humanitarian action to achieve political objectives and the ability of the humanitarian agencies to resist this pressure.
I wonder, too, what you thought about the impact of the emergence of these so-called new powers, China, India, Brazil, Turkey, for example. What impact it's they're having or likely to have on the instrumentalization of humanitarian action?
Well, I think we're perhaps seeing a major shift in the humanitarian wind, or certainly a shifting of paradigms in the way in which emerging powers are looking at their own ways of promoting soft power. Of course, China hasn't actually developed a humanitarian capability per se yet, but I'm pretty sure that there are people in China, like there are people in India, in Indonesia, in Mexico, in Brazil, that are thinking about what is our role as a middle growing power in terms of do we want to manipulate aid? Do we want to become a player on the humanitarian chessboard to compete with the sort of Western and Northern players? I think what we've seen is there's reasons for concern and some reasons for optimism. I think if you look at the final phases of the war in Sri Lanka, it's very clear that the government in Sri Lanka was able to say to the West, we don't need your aid. You know, China is coming to help us. And perhaps this facilitated the strategy that the Sri Lankan government was pursuing of, you know, a final conclusion to the war, and was able to turn a blind eye or a blind ear. Do you have blind ears? A deaf ear to the voices that were critical of the way in which the war was being prosecuted. Mm-hmm. So this is obviously an area of concern. If it becomes so difficult to articulate a humanitarian position in Sri Lanka, you know, if we have more of Sri Lankas in the future, that's clearly going to be very problematical. On the other hand, if we look at the way in which Brazil, Turkey, perhaps Indonesia are putting out feelers on how they look at crisis and the response to crisis, I think there are more positive aspects there. Clearly, in Turkey, the so-called humanitarian NGOs that Turkey has been promoting in the Middle East in particular are very much linked to the political agendas of Turkey. But that's nothing new. We've done it for generations. But at the same time, the fact that there is a debate on humanitarian issues going on in Turkey is a positive thing.
I mean, we all know that there's been a phenomenal growth in aid organizations over the past couple of decades. And the book provides a staggering figure of an estimated $20 billion U.S. dollars going to support people caught up in disasters, both man-made and natural, in 2012 alone. Do you think this growth opens up humanitarian action to greater manipulation?
A question needs to be asked also about the nature of a humanitarian enterprise that has become so big and so linked to the processes of governance. Some would even say that humanitarian action has become part of government, that it's so linked with the foreign policy of states that it's lost, it's drifted away from its principled humanitarian moorings. So I think that there is an issue there, because with growth has come power, I'm not convinced that with this power has also come the responsibility that comes with power. What the book says is that humanitarianism has shifted from being a powerful discourse, a discourse that was based on charity, on the impulse to help and assist people in extremis, and it's now become a discourse of power. It's become a form of power in itself. Perhaps what we need is a clearer identification of those parts of the aid enterprise that are really humanitarian. At one end you have the ICRC and MSF and a few other so-called Dunantist NGOs, NGOs that recognize themselves and the principles developed by the Red Cross movement at the very beginning. And on the other hand, agencies like many of the multi-minded agencies that you see in Afghanistan today that do some humanitarian work but also do development or advocacy or work on issues of rights or justice. And that's very necessary kind of activity, but it's probably an activity that needs to be separated or more clearly defined vis-a-vis humanitarian purist activities. And I think that there remains a very strong niche for the principled humanitarians, particularly in places like Afghanistan or Iraq or Somalia, where the context is extremely fraught and where otherwise it would be very difficult or even impossible to operate.
And looking at the book again, I mean, you sweep through some of the most daunting humanitarian challenges that exist. I mean, countries in crises like Afghanistan, Darfur, Somalia, the occupied Palestinian territories. And then your final chapter is called So What? And I wonder if you could tell us what some of the conclusions are that you came to. Do you have any answers?
So what? No. I mean, because this is an enterprise that is continuously evolving, it's difficult to have a definitive answer. I think perhaps a couple of points. One, it seems that this relationship between humanitarianism and politics and the attempts to manipulate humanitarian action for achieving political or military objectives has been there from the very beginning, is there now. So the question is, can this be changed? Can the relationship between the giver and the receiver, the relationship between the donor and everything else that's happening on the ground, can this be made a more reciprocal relationship? So far, this relationship to me looks like a relationship without reciprocity. We from the north, with our power, our money, and the support of our governments, are here to do certain things and help you populations on the ground. That's a very unsatisfying way of looking at the future of humanitarian action. And I think many of us would like to see, certainly the authors in the book, but in the aid community, there is a push for more accountability to beneficiaries, more attention to the nature of the relationship, whether it's going to be possible to regain some of the sort of voluntary nature, some of the proximity that agencies and NGOs had in the past and that we are losing because of the institutionalization. That's, I think, a major issue. That was one big trend. The other big trend that maybe is worth mentioning is it's unclear whether the love affair between Western donors and aid agencies and humanitarian agencies will continue as it is today. One could look at the growth of the humanitarian enterprise from sort of 2 billion 10 or 15 years ago to close to 20 billion today, as something that happened in parallel with the extension of global capitalism or globalization to the far reaches of the world. And now it seems to me that the West is likely to be entering into a phase of retreat. So if the West is in retreat, if it's going to focus more on its own problems and issues, what does this mean in terms of this $20 billion enterprise? Is it going to continue to grow? Is it going to be able to diversify and to incorporate some of the ideas, approaches coming from the South? How is it going to manage the emergence of more robust sovereignty-based discourses in the South? I think these are the issues that we have to prepare for. And, you know, when China has its own humanitarian bureaucracy, you know, the humanitarianism might be different from what it is today.
No doubt. And finally, Antonio, as we go into the new year, into 2013, are you optimistic that we can find solutions to these dilemmas, that we can find a way forward?
I think I'm optimistic in the sense that these issues are no longer taboo, that these issues are now being discussed, that the issue of instrumentalization and of the impact of what we do or how we are pushed into doing certain things at certain times, there's more openness and also more information. I think that the availability of information to beneficiaries is a very good thing. New social media, mobile phones, the internet allow beneficiaries or groups on the ground, belligerents, states in the South, to have a much better idea of what's going on. And I can give you an anecdote.
Please.
I was in Afghanistan in June looking at the humanitarian situation, and I was speaking to the director of an Afghan NGO who works down in Helmand, in an area where, you know, he's from there, so he knows the Taliban, he knows the governor, he knows everybody. And the Taliban were unhappy about a small project that his organization was going. So he got a message and he was invited to talk to the Taliban Reconstruction Committee for Helmand. So he goes to this meeting and there's two guys behind computers. I said, what are you guys doing? Oh, we're checking the budgets of the NGOs. We want to know where the money comes from. So even if in the most remote areas of sort of Taliban Afghanistan, there are people checking on our budget, I think that's a positive. I think it makes the relationship one that is more open and transparent.
Well, Antonio, I think that's all we have time for today, but I wanted to thank you very much for coming in to speak to us, and I'd urge all of our members to read this very interesting and important book. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.